Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries. One account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. Wise helps you save money no matter where you're going next. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Asylum application rules are changing at the U.S.-Mexico border to deal more efficiently with what could be more migrants. At Mexico's southern border, the number of people is also challenging.
Miles y miles de personas.
There are thousands of migrants here, says this man from Venezuela. He says when they get to the U.S., though, it will all be worth it. Also today, remembering Ben Ferenz, a man who fought hard to prosecute Nazis for war crimes. At Nuremberg, he had blunt words for his fellow prosecutors.
I said, you can't let these bastards get free. You just can't let them go.
A legacy informed by the atrocities he witnessed. And India has long relied on Russia for weapons, but now Russia needs them for its war.
The mainstay of the relationship itself is beginning to crumble.
Ukraine hopes this will push India closer to its camp. Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for starting off the week with us. We begin today with the plight of asylum seekers, people who flee violence and persecution in their home countries and set out for the U.S.-Mexico border. In a few minutes, we'll bring you several voices from Tapachula, a major hub in southern Mexico for migrants arriving from Central America. But first, we're going to explore a new approach U.S. asylum officials are testing out this week. They're screening asylum claims from a limited number of migrants right at the U.S.-Mexico border in temporary facilities. Perhaps more efficient, but the new approach also raises a number of issues about due process and access to legal counsel. To learn more, we reached out to Lee Gelernt. He's a deputy director at the American Civil Liberties Union. Lee, what does this new approach at the border actually look like on the ground?
So we don't know yet, and the administration has not revealed many details, if at all. What we do know is that the Trump administration tried this, and it was a disaster for asylum seekers. And I want to be clear, we are not opposed to a more efficient system, but it has to contain due process. What we saw under the Trump administration is asylum interviews being conducted essentially incommunicado from attorneys, happening very quickly, and no one had a fair chance to present their case. And to be clear, no one is saying that everybody who seeks asylum is entitled to get asylum and to remain in the country, but everyone should be entitled to a fair hearing to present their claims. We said after World War II, we would never send people back to danger without a fair chance to present their case.
As for the timing of this limited process, I mean, there's a reason it's happening this week, as most everyone at the border is really aware. May 11th, zooming up in 1 month, a pandemic-related rule that has suspended rights to seek asylum will expire. How is that going to compound problems for border officials?
What I think people are not paying attention to is what many states have said, including said to the U.S. Supreme Court, is that they are likely to challenge the end of Title 42 on May 11th. In fact, the ACLU was supposed to be in the Supreme Court arguing on March 1st to end Title 42. That case was taken off the Supreme Court's calendar because the Biden administration said they would end Title 42 on May 11th. But the states quickly said they were going to challenge that. Assuming, however, that Title 42 ends on May 11th, I think the real issue to pay attention to is the Biden administration's proposal of a new rule to take the place of Title 42. And again, it's a Trump administration rule. It says if you've transited through a third country, you're going to be presumptively ineligible for asylum. Sounds good on its face, but everyone knows that the countries that you transit through don't have fair functioning asylum systems and that you'll be in danger waiting around to apply for asylum in countries like Mexico and Guatemala. So I think this aspect of the problem, having these hearings in Border Patrol stations, is very, very important and troubling. But the bigger issue is that the Biden administration is essentially going to not have asylum access for most people And that's, again, a Trump administration policy. I argued that case under the Trump administration. We were successful. Now here we are 2.5 years later, them reaching for another Trump administration policy.
Would you agree that the number of asylum seekers is likely to be even more overwhelming after Title 42 expires next month? And if that is the case, what do you think will be done?
Are there a lot of people trying to come to the U.S.? Of course, that's always the case. But we have enough resources to provide a fair asylum hearing for people, and we really need to do it. It's not just legally required. I think it's morally required. People need to ask themselves why all of a sudden they're turning their back on people seeking asylum when for many, many years we said we would never send people back to danger.
Lee, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lee Gelernt is the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. We hear a lot about migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, but crossing into Mexico's southern border from Guatemala also presents huge challenges for migrants fleeing poverty and violence across Latin America. Reporter Michael Fox brings us this story from the Guatemala-Mexico border.
Hundreds of migrants walk in the midday heat on the shoulder of a dry two-lane highway in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas. Most of the people in this group are Venezuelan. Exxon Bravo is one of them. He's clean-shaven and wears a gray Quicksilver t-shirt. He's been traveling for the last month, up from South America, through the jungle, across Central America, and he's not alone. There are so many people, he says, thousands and thousands, from every country, Colombia, Haiti, China, Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru, he says. Everyone's destination is the same, the U.S. border. When we're on the other side, it'll be worth it, he says. Every sacrifice has its reward. But those rewards aren't guaranteed. Tapachula is the major hub in Mexico for migrants arriving from Central America. It's a bustling, gritty city of 350,000. Most cross into the country illegally from Guatemala. Once here, people try to get official papers that allow them to travel north across the country and scratch together money for the journey. The main square downtown is packed around the clock, mainly with Haitian migrants. They change money, give haircuts, sell phone SIM cards. Migrant René Casales hawks bottled water and soda out of a large trash can that he pushes on a wheelbarrow. It's really hard here, he says. There's no work. I was up at 6 a.m., but I haven't sold anything. If I could leave Tapachula now, I'd do it in a heartbeat, he says. René and his wife walked here from Chile, where they'd lived before. They've been here for 11 days, but officials tell them it'll be at least 3 months before they can get papers. That's the average wait for most Haitians who want to legalize their status in Mexico. With the constant arrival of new migrants, housing is a problem. Many sleep on the streets. One of them is Edimar Rocio. She's a young, single, pregnant mother from Venezuela who traveled with her two children to get here. She arrived 2 days ago, and she's begging for change. The trip has been really hard, but not impossible with the help of God, she says. We've faced humiliations, disrespect, we've been robbed. It's been terrible, she says. Like many Venezuelan migrants, she's hoping to acquire a transit visa just to get across the state of Chiapas. Usually, it can take less than a week, but now, she says, Tapachula's immigrant agency is backlogged. It's not surprising. Thousands of transit and humanitarian visas are processed in this city every month. Today, at Mexico's Refugee Aid Commission, the main place where people apply for refugee status, there's a line stretching out the door. Daladier Ransueto is the head of the commission. He says the arrival of migrants into the region has been growing ever since the big caravans of 2018. This year, it looks like we're going to surpass all previous records, he says. In just the first 3 months of 2023, 20,000 people have already requested refugee status, just at this office, he says. People from Haiti and Venezuela are encouraged by U.S. President Joe Biden's new policy to prioritize migrants from their countries, along with Nicaragua and Cuba. They tell me it's a little easier for those four countries, says street vendor René Casales. A little better. No one is certain they'll be able to make it across the U.S. border, but everyone is hopeful. For the world, I'm Michael Fox in Tapachula, Mexico.
The last surviving prosecutor of Nazi war crimes at Nuremberg has died. Benjamin Ferenc was 103 years old. When he was a young man, he secured the convictions of 22 Nazi death squad leaders in what's been called the biggest murder trial in history. Even after that historic drama, Ferenc never stopped fighting for justice. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more on the life of Ben Ferenc.
Vengeance is not our goal, nor do we seek merely a just retribution.
This is Ben Ferenc in 1947, presenting his opening argument before the court at Nuremberg. The accused, all imposing middle-aged men, were SS officers charged with killing 1 million people in towns and villages across Eastern Europe. Ferenc was 27 years old, and this was his first case. He was barely 5 feet tall and had to stand on a stack of books to reach the courtroom lectern. But Ferenc spoke with a calm authority.
We ask this court to affirm by international penal action man's right to live in peace and dignity, regardless of his race or creed.
Ferenc was born in 1920 in a small town in what is now Romania. He immigrated to the U.S. with his family when he was still a baby. He was the first in his family to go to college and then earned a scholarship to Harvard Law. Ferenc enlisted in the army after graduation and fought in the Battle of the Bulge in Belgium. At the end of World War II, Ferenc, because of his legal background, was tasked with gathering evidence of Nazi war crimes in Germany. One of the researchers on his team found detailed reports kept by the Einsatzgruppen, which were special SS units that roamed Nazi-occupied Eastern Europe and massacred entire Jewish communities.
Their assignment was to kill, without pity or remorse, every single Jewish man, woman, or child they could catch.
This is Ferenc speaking to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in 2020. Ferenc explained the Germans were meticulous record keepers, and their reports told Ferenc everything he needed to know.
I knew when they entered which town. I knew from their report how many Jews they killed. And I sat at a little adding machine, and I added them up. And I reached over 100 people murdered, according to their reports. I got on the next plane. I flew down to Nuremberg. I met with Telford Taylor.
General Telford Taylor was the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg.
I said, General, we got to put on a new trial.
But the thing was, the Nuremberg trials were already underway. The budget had been set, the lawyers had been assigned, and the Pentagon didn't want any more trials. So Taylor said no.
He said, we can't. We just can't put on a new trial. I said, you can't let these bastards get free. You just can't let them go. He said, okay, you do it. And so it came to pass.
All 22 defendants were convicted. Four were executed. After Nuremberg, Ferenc dedicated his life to his personal motto.
Three words, law, not war.
He said, law continues to be humanity's hope for a more just and peaceful world. Ferenc played a crucial role in the creation of the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and he was chosen at age 91 to deliver a closing statement in the court's first case, the prosecution of the Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga Dilo.
The most significant advance I have observed in international law has gone almost unnoticed. It is the slow awakening of the human conscience.
Ben Ferenc always tried to prod that human conscience, says his son, Don Ferenc.
My dad, literally every single day of his life, would be on the computer or out lecturing, traveling, giving interviews, and advocating for international justice causes.
He was an inspiration, says Don.
When my three sisters and I were growing up, my father used to say to us, don't leave a place the way you found it. Leave it the way you would like to have found it.
Ben Ferenc, last living Nuremberg prosecutor, was 103 years old. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The war in Yemen has been going on for nearly a decade. In 2014, fighters from northern Yemen, loyal to the al-Houthi family, took over Yemen's capital. They put the country's president under house arrest and marched through the country's largest cities. A few months later, Saudi Arabia tried to stop the Houthis' advance with a shock and awe-style bombing campaign. That was 8 years ago. Since then, the Saudis have not been able to defeat the Houthis, and now they're talking peace. To explain where things are today, we reached out to Osama al-Rouhani of the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies. He's in Oxford, England. The image is stunning, Osama, a Houthi leader greeting a group of Saudi diplomats in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. As a Yemeni, what was the first thing that came to your mind when you saw that picture?
Everybody is really excited for the conflict to come to an end. But they have these mixed feelings with sadness of how this war has damaged Yemen's economy, has damaged its infrastructure, but most of all, have shed the blood of a lot of Yemenis.
So how will those considerations be dealt with as Saudis and Yemenis come together to discuss?
For Yemenis, it doesn't mean much. People look at it with so much concern because talks that is supposed to happen should not be between Saudis and the Houthis. It should be between the Houthis and the anti-Houthi groups. Still, it has some glimpse of hope, such as the payment of salaries, the opening of ports, sea and airports, but also establishing for a political transitional process.
Right. So salaries, airports, a transition process. Is that on paper in some way? Is there any deal that's been proffered yet?
So these are the main topics, but there's been a lot of differences on how to approach this. It's what the Houthis have actually demanded. And also, these are the titles that the Saudis have shared with the Yemeni Presidential Leadership Council before heading to Sana'a to meet with the Houthis.
Yeah, so break that down for us, Osama. Whose interests are served by this deal?
The ones that took initiatives on this are the Saudis, mainly. Definitely, the items of this agreement is to serve the Yemenis, but the behind interest of it is for Saudis. So for Houthis to stop shelling and send rockets to Saudi, stop the fights also in the Saudi borders. So on that end, Saudi has been, all their talks and the concessions that they have provided to Houthis is to ensure that these are conditions are actually met. Definitely the Yemenis will benefit from this as a ceasefire all across the country, which is again also one of the items in the agreement. But the question of it is, it will it really last or no? For Saudis, maybe it will. For Yemenis, it is not really clear. And that's why everybody is looking at it with alarm and concern.
As you probably know, there's speculation that an agreement could be completed before Ramadan ends on the 20th of April. I mean, if there is some agreement in a couple of weeks after nearly 10 years of war, how surprising would that be?
Yeah, it's not surprising for Saudis. They have always have these, they call it the last 10-day diplomacy, the last 10-day of Ramadan diplomacy, where they usually broker peace deals on these 10 days because they're holidays. But I am not excited about this because it doesn't seem that it has all the pieces for a successful peace process. But it's not a bad start.
Osama al-Rouhani is executive director for policy and partnerships at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, giving us background on direct talks between Yemen's Houthi-led government and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Osama, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
They call it the 44-day war. That's when Armenia and Azerbaijan battled over disputed territory in the Nagorno-Karabakh region in 2020. In the past few years, there have been sporadic outbursts of violence between the two sides. Now, Armenians are worried that another war is inevitable, and there's one weapon that has people especially concerned. From the Armenian capital, Yerevan, Levi Bridges reports.
One of the weapons that played a role in that 44-day war is the Bayraktar TB2. It's a drone manufactured in Turkey that's small enough to fit in your kitchen, but it can carry bombs, and it's relatively cheap to build. Ukraine's military has also used Bayraktars. In fact, the drone is so revered in Ukraine, there's even a song about it. Прийшли окупанти до нас в Україну, форма новенька, воєнні машини та трохи поплавився їх інвентар. In the music video, Ukrainian soldiers dance beside destroyed Russian tanks, spray-painted with expletives as they sing the Bayraktar's praises.
Бойрактар. Bayraktar.
So in Ukraine, these Turkish-made drones are seen as a force for good, but for Armenians, they're a threat. Back in 2020, Azerbaijan's military used the weapons to knock out Armenia's defenses and seize large swaths of Nagorno-Karabakh. After the war, trucks carrying Bayraktars rolled through Azerbaijan's capital, Baku, in a military parade. But if you mention Bayraktar to some Armenians, they'll talk about war crimes. Arman Tatayan is a former Armenian human rights official.
These drones were used not only against military, but also to bomb, to destroy civilian communities.
Turkey, where the drones are made, is a close ally with Azerbaijan. And Tatayan says the Turkish military helped guide Azerbaijan's use of the drones. In Yerevan, I meet a woman named Margarita Karamyan, who fled the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh. Hunched over a laptop, Karamyan shows me pictures of a building with a gaping hole in it that she says was hit by a Bayraktar drone. Then she tells me about the menacing buzzing sound these weapons make. Here it is, captured from a video on YouTube. Karamyan says she'd hear this for hours as the drone circled above her hometown. The sound is psychological torture, she tells me. You just wait, wondering if you're about to be killed. Proving whether these drones are responsible for war crimes, like killing civilians, is tricky. Anahit Haratsunyan is with the Center for Truth and Justice, a law clinic in Armenia. She says it's rare to find debris in war zones with serial numbers intact that clearly identify where they came from.
Because after the explosion, everything is like nothing left.
The Bayraktars were not just used to drop bombs in 2020. Leonid Nursisyan is a military analyst at an Armenian think tank.
Drones provide you high-quality videos, and they are helpful in information warfare.
He says Turkish drones are still a major threat because Armenia never replenished its air defense systems after the last war. Armenia also gets most of its arms from Russia, which is overextended in Ukraine. And now, some Armenians are preparing for another round of fighting with Azerbaijan. In an old movie theater in Yerevan, a school called Vama teaches civilians combat skills. A man dressed in army fatigues directs a group of men and women carrying fake AK-47s. Vagnyak Vartanov helps run the training program. He says they're teaching Armenians how to stay alive. We can't count on the West for help, he says, so we have to defend ourselves. For the world, Levi Bridges, Yerevan, Armenia.
We're back with you in a moment for more news in the next 30 minutes of the show. You're listening to The World. New document leaks are shedding light on the war in Ukraine and the Pentagon's role in all of it. Nobody knows who did the leak, but some close on the trail believe whoever was behind it was not motivated by idealism.
And from what I understand, it's just somebody trying to impress his friends.
That is, if the bragger is indeed the leaker. We'll learn more still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's been 10 months since protesters in Sri Lanka forced out the president. At the time, the country couldn't afford to import fuel, medicine, and food. Sri Lanka's economic crisis has calmed down, relatively speaking. A long-awaited rescue loan from the International Monetary Fund is also coming through. As the world's Carolyn Beeler reports, that has helped brought a fragile sense of stability to Sri Lanka.
For part of last year, life across Sri Lanka largely ground to a halt. Economic mismanagement and shocks from the COVID pandemic meant the country had run out of dollars to buy necessities like gasoline. In the city of Colombo, people waited in line outside gas stations for several days at a time, hoping for a chance to fill up. Compared to then, Colombo-based economist Shayu Damsingha says it feels like the country's economic freefall is over.
And I think there is a very cautious sense of optimism returning to the people.
Gasoline is tightly rationed but available. Inflation has dropped from a high of 74% in September to 50% last month. Regularly scheduled power cuts ended in February. Dham Singha says people can feel the change.
Things might not be getting worse and worse. There might be a light at the end of the tunnel. We might actually be in a tunnel that has light at the end of it.
The International Monetary Fund finalized a long-awaited $3 billion bailout deal late last month. The first $333 million reached Sri Lanka a few days later. Here's the IMF's Peter Brewer announcing the deal.
We've been deeply concerned about the impact of the crisis. Today's board approval marks an important step towards the resolution of this crisis.
But that resolution is expected to be slow, and many poor and working-class Sri Lankans are still hurting. When I met Muhammad Safri in July, he couldn't get gas for the motorbike he used to make money delivering takeout. Now, there is fuel and we can work, he said this week. But the cost of living is so high that what I earn isn't enough. Government statistics show food prices in Colombo are more than twice as high as they were 2 years ago. But many people say that figure doesn't accurately reflect the price spikes of many staples. Prices are extremely high now, Safri says. 1,000 rupees can buy only what 100 rupees could buy back then. Safri, who says his family used to be middle class, hasn't been able to afford an egg for his young daughter for more than 2 weeks. The family is Muslim and observing Ramadan, but when they break their fast each evening, there isn't much food on the table. All we can eat is what we receive from the mosque, like dates, he says, while steering his motorbike through the city. At Community Kitchens, launched last year to serve the hungry, organizer Moses Prakash says there are still plenty of mouths to feed.
The demand is still the same, I would say. Demand is still the same.
The kitchens are run by the foundation Voice for Voiceless. I visited one in Colombo last July. At the time, a volunteer stirred up a vegetable curry over a wood fire on a roof.
Sri Lanka, no gas.
Back then, they were using firewood because there was no cooking gas to buy. Now, Prakash says,
we are still using firewood because gas is available, but it's not affordable.
Gas and electricity prices in Sri Lanka have spiked, and the government has lowered some subsidies to comply with International Monetary Fund requirements. Food insecurity in Sri Lanka remains high. But Moses Prakash says things do feel a little more stable these days.
Comparing to where we were last year at this time, we are in a better place, that I would agree.
Economist Shayu Dham Singha expects the Sri Lankan economy to see a full year of growth next year, and he's paying attention to a seasonal indicator near his home in Colombo. A shopping district is bustling again, with near-normal levels of people buying clothes ahead of the Sinhalese New Year at the end of the week.
The fact that people feel confident enough that even when things are not that great, to still consume what is going to be a significant amount of money for them, I think is an indication that people are also a little bit more confident about the future of the economy.
IMF payments to Sri Lanka will be tied to reviews that take place every 6 months. The development lender is also requiring the country to address corruption and governance issues as part of the deal. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Another document leak has Washington again circling the wagons. Among other things, the documents reveal critical information about Ukraine's military preparedness, tantalizing clues about how NATO is planning to back a possible offensive, and how the U.S. has penetrated into Russia's intelligence services. Little is known about who actually leaked the documents or why. Eric Toller from the online investigative journalism outlet Bellingcat has been following the leak closely. He's been on the move today with his family, but he joins us to discuss. Eric, remind us, what kinds of documents are in this leak?
Yeah, so there are about 107, or give or take one or two, files that have been floating around. And these come originally from Discord, which is kind of a community platform mostly used for gaming. It's kind of like a mix of Slack and IRC, if anyone remembers that from back in the day. And these files are about all sorts of stuff. Most of them focus on Ukraine and Russia and the war there, but there are a bunch that are also intelligence reports from signal intelligence. So, for example, in South Korea, on Syria, and other topics as well, too.
So you mentioned this platform that this leak appeared on. Originally, these documents came out of the Pentagon, correct?
it looks like these documents mostly come from the Department of Defense. We don't know exactly where they come from, but a lot of them are marked secret, top secret. And among them, there are some CIA reports, though we don't know who the actual source is.
What do you find to be some of the most enlightening information in this leak?
So a lot of it paints kind of a little bit more accurate picture of the war in Ukraine that we may not have known about. So some of the details are things like air defense positions of the Ukrainian and schedules for ammo replenishment. And there's also some word on things like South Korean reticence to provide lethal aid, because they have a ban on providing lethal aid, for example, and they were really reticent about certain ammunition sales because they were worried that it would end up in the hands of Ukraine, even if it passed through one or two conduits on the way. So you get kind of a more unfiltered view of kind of geopolitics through these documents.
I mean, some of the information from what I've seen is not exactly classified, estimated death tolls on the Ukrainian and Russian military side. Would you say that some of this is actually, in fact, quite secretive?
What's in kind of the secret documents aren't exactly, I don't know, different than what's in the public record. For example, the casualty counts about killed in action and from the Ukrainian and Russian side are very similar to what you hear from the Pentagon briefs. So a lot of it is also just kind of open source reporting. But, you know, if anything, it's nice to know that the big wigs with the top secret documents kind of corroborate some of the assumptions we already have about the war.
So get ready now for a wildly speculative question. Who could be behind this leak? And could it be a disinformation campaign?
No. So there's one element of a disinformation campaign. These documents first made a public appearance in February, and they kind of filtered around between 4chan and a few other places before they found their way onto some Russian Telegram channels. And there's one little thing. There's like one little box in one document that was edited by a Russian kind of bad actor. But everything else seems to be real. And the Pentagon is reacting as if it's real. As far as I know, because I've talked to some of the people who were in the original place where these first appeared. It's a tiny Discord server, 20, 30 people in there. And from what I understand, it's just somebody trying to impress his friends. It was just a guy who had access to documents trying to impress his buddies and trying to show off kind of and kind of flex about some of the information he had access to.
Like right in the middle of some online game, they're flexing and, well, my flex is going to be I'm going to reveal some stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there was a server where they played a bunch of games on Steam and Call of Duty and Halo and all that, and they had a channel in there that happened to have hundreds and hundreds of leaked documents.
Wow. The documents do refer to things happening inside Russian security agencies almost in real time. Is there a risk that this could expose U.S. sources?
Yeah, theoretically. I mean, I guess it could. And I've heard reports that Ukraine had to change some of its war plans based on the activities or some of the information in there. So, I mean, it's led to some on-the-ground changes already. And also, I'm sure that there's been a lot less trust from U.S. allies after this has happened, too.
As far as some of the documents that may have been doctored, what do we know about that and why the doctoring would have occurred?
Well, this is only one fragment of one document. And it was this fragment just made the war situation look worse for Ukraine and better for Russia. It just because the original document had Russian casualties higher than that of Ukraine, like quadrupled the number of Ukrainian losses.
Eric, what could this leak imply potentially for Ukraine as the war continues?
The situation is not great. Not that they're on the verge of collapse or anything, but that some of their ammunition situation is not great. Maybe just they need a little bit more help with replenishment of some ammo is kind of the big thing. And if there's political will from the rest of the world to help them out with that, it's kind of maybe the most critical thing that comes out of this.
Eric Toler from the online investigative journalism outlet Bellingcat, thanks very much for helping us understand this better.
Sure. Thanks.
No country imports more weapons than India. Almost half of its stockpile comes from Russia. The defense trade has been the cornerstone of the two countries' strong ties, which go back to the Cold War. Enter Ukraine. It would like to shake up that relationship and also get India to change its neutral position on the war in Ukraine. Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs is visiting India this week. Amina Japarova spoke with reporters in New Delhi and said Ukraine is not instructing India, just advising them to diversify their sources of weapons.
Because what we see in my country, when you are dependent from Russia, they will always use this blackmail instrument. So I think that India should be pragmatic.
Ukraine might be getting its wish, Sushmita Patak reports from Delhi.
Army tanks, surface-to-air missiles, rifles, India buys a wide range of equipment from Russia. One of the Indian Navy's two flagships is a former Russian warship, and much of the Indian Air Force fleet is of Russian origin.
And this is the Trishul formation. Three Sukhoi 30 aircraft.
including these Sukhoi fighter jets that whizzed over onlookers during Republic Day celebrations in the Indian capital this year. But in March, a major delivery of Russian weapons fell through because of the war in Ukraine. Supply of the vital S-400 air defense system and other equipment is now delayed indefinitely. Rajeshwari Pillai is a defense analyst at the Delhi-based Observer Research Foundation.
The mainstay of the relationship itself is like it's beginning to crumble, and I think this will also put into question the feasibility of maintaining that relationship in the longer term.
Over the past year, India has been walking a diplomatic tightrope between Russia and the West. While Prime Minister Narendra Modi has called for an end to the fighting in Ukraine, he has not criticized President Vladimir Putin. And India has abstained from voting in several United Nations resolutions condemning Russia. There's also another complication.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has arrived in Moscow for his first visit.
Moscow is getting closer to Beijing, New Delhi's biggest rival. India and China are in the middle of a border dispute that's led to violent clashes in recent years. As China emerges as Russia's most important partner, here's a question that Indian policymakers may be asking themselves.
Given the Russia-China alignment, how reliable is Russia as a partner?
That's Rajan Menon from the Washington-based think tank Defense Priorities. Russia and China's relationship is making India uncomfortable. But despite the national security implications, Pillai says New Delhi will still want to keep Russia close.
Unless we really stay close to Russia and not isolate them, not abandon them, Russia will grow closer, even further closer to China. So we need to avoid that. I think that will be still the argument that you will hear on the Indian side. I don't think India will abandon that Russia relationship completely.
At a conference in March, India's Foreign Minister Subramaniam Jaishankar echoed that sentiment.
India-Russia relations have remained extraordinarily stable, and I put it to you, there is a deeper underlying convergence, a geopolitical convergence.
The convergence dates back to the early years of the Cold War, when Moscow emerged as the main supplier of weapons to New Delhi, while the US was backing India's rival Pakistan. India hasn't forgotten that, says Rajan Menon. But at the same time, he says India has also been moving closer to the West, particularly the US.
India will kind of play a balanced role between Russia and the West, and will not put itself in a position where it'll be forced to make a choice.
Doing so increases India's leverage, Menon says. On the defense front, the Ukraine war has been a reality check for India, says Rajeshwari Pillai. Long delays in getting vital defense supplies could leave India in a vulnerable position against neighbors like China.
And I think this really would call for some introspection in terms of how India needs to have a fresh review of its defense capability acquisition, whether Russia would continue to be a reliable player or not.
India has been ramping up efforts to reduce its dependence on Russia. Russian weapons make up 45% of India's defense imports, down from 85% during the Cold War. They're being replaced by France, Israel, and the United States. Despite the eroding defense trade ties, Menon says the India-Russia relationship will survive.
I expect it to evolve rather than to take a sharp turn one way or the other.
Meanwhile, India has become one of the largest importers of Russian oil this past year, and trade between the two is at a record high. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Delhi.
It is the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, so we wanted you to enjoy once more one of our favorite stories from last year about Muslim superheroes and a day that forever changed the life of Canadian Iman Vellani. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
Vellani was sitting in her friend's driveway when her phone pinged. Someone from the Marvel Cinematic Universe was asking her to join a Zoom meeting. Turns out, Kevin Feige, president of Marvel Studios, was on the line with a message.
You want me to do it?
Yeah.
Come on, you did amazing work. You've done amazing work, and we'd be honored if you would play Kamala Khan for us in the Miss Marvel show. And it was a unanimous decision.
Oh, my God.
Vellani said she wasn't able to comprehend the fact that she'd landed the role of Kamala Khan, the lead character in Marvel's Disney Plus show called Miss Marvel. Before this gig, Vellani had little to no acting experience. But when she heard about the casting call, it felt like fate. She's a huge Miss Marvel fan, as she explained to Toronto's Now magazine.
I read all of the comics when I was in high school. I dressed up as her for Halloween, and so she was very much a prominent, character in my life.
In fact, acting chops weren't necessary in this case. Vellani herself is remarkably similar to her character. Kamala Khan is the first Muslim superhero in Marvel history.
It's not really the brown girls from Jersey City who saved the world.
In the show, Khan struggles to fit in at school. Her parents immigrated from Pakistan, just like Vellani's parents did in real life. Vellani says growing up in Canada, she felt pretty disconnected from her culture, in part because she didn't see anyone like herself on screen.
Being brown in Hollywood never really went hand in hand. I never saw myself represented in that light, so I felt like, okay, I can't be myself if I want to be a part of this world.
But on the red carpet at the show's Toronto premiere, Vellani talked about being the change she has always wanted to see.
Film and TV literally shape how we see people in this world. And so, you know, when you're only representing Muslims in a certain type of light, it gets very one note. And I'm so glad that Marvel's providing space for a character like Kamala to exist and to just take up space.
Vellani adds that, importantly, being Muslim isn't Khan's entire life. She's a powerful superhero who just happens to be Pakistani and Muslim. That story is already striking a chord.
That was awesome! Oh my God, I'm crying right now.
Muslim fans are posting reaction videos to the trailer on YouTube.
Oh my God, that's her, that's Kamala.
Okay, I like that. It felt heartwarming.
The much-anticipated Ms. Marvel show premiered on Disney Plus last summer, and fans are currently waiting for news on a second season. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The 1960s comedy troupe The Firesign Theater once joked that our forefathers took drugs. It was a bit. It turns out it's also true. Humans taking psychoactive drugs, that goes back thousands of years. That's according to a new study conducted by researchers in Europe. They found traces of alkaloid substances in 3,000-year-old strands of human hair. Those substances can cause euphoria or delirium. Benjamin Breen knows about this world. He's the author of The Age of Intoxication and also an associate professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Benjamin, where exactly was his hair found by the researchers?
It was found in a cave in the island of Menorca in the Western Mediterranean. And this is really interesting because one of the earliest places where opium use has been documented is also the Western Mediterranean. So this is adding to an existing series of studies that have been done, finding that drugs have been used in this Bronze Age Mediterranean world since at least 3,000 years ago.
And is it understood where these alkaloid substances came from? I mean, what was the drug? Do we know that?
Yeah, we do. We know that there's three categories that they found. I won't get into the chemical details, but we definitely know that at least two of the categories of drugs, traces that they found, relate to a group of plants that are commonly known as nightshade, or may also, people might have heard the term belladonna, or jimson weed is another one that people may know. These are a category of plants that are usually thought of as poisonous, but if we go back into medieval, early modern, and even Greek and Roman herbals, books of medicinal lore relating to herbs, we find that they've been used medicinally for a very long time, and also ritually in the context of divination, like prophecies, possibly in other forms of shamanistic use.
And the fact that these traces were found in human hair, I mean, what's that about?
Well, it's one of the most common ways of identifying drugs. People may have experienced this in their own lives when they've taken a drug test. It's not perfect because some traces of drugs don't survive. For instance, actually opium alkaloids, which is what they call the chemical compound, they're usually not able to persist for very long. So the authors of this study were not able to test for opium compounds. But the other ones, the ones that are known as tropanes, and also a compound related to ephedrine, which is a stimulant drug kind of similar to amphetamines, those survive for a very long time in human hair.
What does this study tell us exactly about the relationship between humans and psychoactive drugs that we did not already know?
I think it's confirming a lot of studies that have been done over the past several decades that show a universal aspect to psychoactive drug use. You know, we tend to think about drugs in the present, and even the term itself, drug, and this is one of the things that my book, The Age of Intoxication, gets into. Drug has a lot of contemporary meanings that we associate, for instance, with drugstores, drug companies, drug dealers. And we sort of sort these substances into social categories that are relevant to the people of the present. And what we have to remember is that the same substances persist and are used in very, very different contexts, in different cultures, across thousands of years. And so this is confirming on the one hand, the universal nature of the use of psychoactive substances, that they really are a core aspect of human nature and human history.
I mean, Benjamin, today there is some acceptance of psychoactive drugs and their role in treating psychological trauma. There are also more conventional views of hallucinogens as just dangerous. Do we know anything about societal thinking on psychoactive drugs like 3,000 years ago in Spain?
Well, one thing that's really interesting is that these specific drugs, like henbane as an example, even though we don't have written records from 3,000 years ago, we do have written records from the time of the Greeks and Romans, so roughly 2,000 years ago. And I was looking up what Pliny the Elder, the famous Roman author on medical topics and all sorts of other things, wrote about henbane. And he says it's of the nature of wine and therefore offensive to the understanding. So there's an interesting history of people, specifically people who are medical authorities, sort of casting doubt on the role of substances that change your mind in a way that, as Pliny put it, is offensive to the understanding, meaning perhaps it changes your point of view, makes you think differently. And so there's something interesting to be said about charting a deeper history of contemporary opposition to substances that do that, and thinking about it not just as something that manifests in the present or in the 20th and 21st centuries, but really has like a 1,000 or 2,000 year history. But I would be so interested to know what people who lived in that island 3,000 years ago debated about these substances, whether they were fully accepted, whether the people who used them were in some ways outsiders. This is the kind of thing that we can't answer in this one context, but we do need to know more about as we sort of chart the future of these substances today.
Fascinating discussion. Benjamin Breen is an associate professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, also the author of the book, The Age of Intoxication. Benjamin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marco. It was great to be here.
It has been 2 months since earthquakes killed more than 50,000 people and leveled buildings in Turkey and Syria. Tomorrow on the program, we visit the Turkish province of Hatay. People there are living in greenhouses, tent camps, or containers. Prices for survival gear has skyrocketed, but life, seriously altered, goes on and people are finding creative ways to get by. That's tomorrow, here on The World. Traveling Medicine Man is the title of a new album from Bai Camara Jr. and the Voodoo Sniffers. It's another take on the world of shamans and medicine men who are not necessarily MDs. For Bai Camara Jr., the title of his recording was inspired by his maternal grandfather, who was born in Sierra Leone and educated by Protestant missionaries. The grandfather traveled with those missionaries across the country, providing medical care to villagers and townspeople. I'm a good man, but I got a bad reputation. A good man with a good reputation. Bai Camara Jr., the musician, was born in Bowtown, Sierra Leone. His dad was a politician, his mom an ambassador. Camara moved to Europe at the age of 15, and as civil war was breaking out back home, he settled in Brussels, where he's lived for the past 30 years. Camara is committed to strengthening the musical branches that extend from West Africa to modern music, especially their connection to the blues. His songs are personal and also take on themes of political corruption and abuse of power. His song, Good Good Man, does both. Camara's grandfather should be a reminder to leaders about how to take care of their own citizens. Oh, yes, indeed. I'm a good man. But I've got a bad reputation. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.